shorts, a threaded hole with a flange, where brisk, white-suited ATHSCME guys will attach some of the lungs' arterial pneumatic tubing at some point soon, when Stitt et al., on staff, decide the real weather has moved past enduring for outdoor tennis. During winter months, when any expelled odor would get ducted up into the lung and hang there conspicuous, Hal mostly goes into a remote sub-dormitory lavatory and climbs onto a toilet in a stall and exhales into the grill of one of the little exhaust fans in the ceiling. But this routine lacks a certain intricate subterranean covert drama. It's another reason why Hal dreads Interdependence Day and the approach of the Whataburger Classic and Thanksgiving and unendurable weather and the erection of the lung. Recreational drugs are more or less traditional at any U.S. secondary school, maybe because of the unprecedented tensions, post-latency, and puberty, and angst, and impending adulthood, etc., to help manage the intra-psychic storms, etc. Since the place's inception, there's always been a certain percentage of the high-caliber adolescent players at ETA who manage their internal weathers chemically. Much of this is good, clean, temporary fun, but a traditionally smaller and harder core set tends to rely on personal chemistry to manage ETA's special demands, dexedrine or low-volt methadrine,
5
before matches, and benzodiazepines to come back down after matches,
6
with mudslides or blue flames at some understanding Commonwealth Avenue night spot,
7
or beers and bongs in some discreet academy corner at night to short-circuit the up-and-down cycle, mushrooms or X or something from the mild designer class,
8
or maybe, occasionally, a little black star,
9
whenever there's a match and demand-free weekend, to basically short out the whole motherboard and blow out all the circuits and slowly recover and be almost neurologically reborn and start the gradual cycle all over again. This circular routine, if your basic wiring's okay to begin with, can work surprisingly well throughout adolescence and sometimes into one's, like, early 20s before it starts to creep up on you. But so, some ETAs, not just Hal and Condensa by any means, are involved with recreational substances, is the point. Like, who isn't at some life stage in the USA and interdependent regions in these troubled times for the most part? Though a decent percentage of ETA students aren't at all, i.e., involved. Some persons can give themselves away to an ambitious pursuit and have that be all the giving themselves away to something they need to do. Though sometimes this changes as the players get older and the pursuit more stress-fraught. American experience seems to suggest that people are virtually unlimited in their need to give themselves away on various levels. Some just prefer to do it in secret. An enrolled student-athlete's use of alcohol or illicit chemicals is cause for immediate expulsion, according to ETA's admissions catalog. But the ETA staff tends to have a lot more important stuff on its plate than policing kids who've already given themselves away to an ambitious competitive pursuit. The administrative attitude under first James Incandenza and then Charles Tavis is like, why would anybody who wanted to compromise his faculties chemically even come here to ETA, where the whole point is to stress and stretch your faculties along multiple vectors?
10.
And since it's the alumni pro-rectors who have the most direct supervisory contact with the kids, and since most of the pro-rectors themselves are depressed or traumatized about not making it into the show and having to come back to ETA and live in decent but subterranean rooms off the tunnels and work as assistant coaches and teach laughable elective classes, which is what the 8 ETA pro-rectors do when they're not off playing satellite tournaments or trying to make it through the qualifying rounds of some serious money event, and so they're morose and low on morale and feel bad about themselves often, as a rule, and so, also not all that surprisingly, tend to get high now and then themselves, though in a less covert or exuberant fashion than the hardcore students' chemical cadre. But so, Given all this, it's not hard to see why internal drug enforcement at ETA tends to be flaccid. The other nice thing about the pump room is the way it's connected by tunnel to the prorector's rows of housing units, which means men's rooms, which means Hal can crawl, hunch, and tiptoe into an unoccupied men's room and brush his teeth with his portable Oral-B and wash his face and apply eye drops and Old Spice and a plug of wintergreen Kodiak and then saunter back to the sauna area and ascend to ground level, looking and smelling right as rain. Because when he gets high, he develops a powerful obsession with having nobody, not even the neurochemical cadre, know he's high. This obsession is almost irresistible in its force. The amount of organization and toiletry lugging he has to do to get secretly high in front of a subterranean outtake vent in the pre-supper gap would make a lesser man quail. Hal has no idea why this is, or whence this obsession with the secrecy of it. He broods on it abstractly at times, when high. This no-one-must-know thing. It's not fear per se, fear of discovery. Beyond that, it all gets too abstract and twined up to lead to anything, Hal's brooding. Like most North Americans of his generation, Hal tends to know way less about why he feels certain ways about the objects and pursuits he's devoted to than he does about the objects and pursuits themselves. It's hard to say for sure whether this is even exceptionally bad, this tendency. At 0015 hours, the 2nd of April, the medical attaché's wife is just leaving the Mount Auburn Total Fitness Center, having played 5 6-game pro sets in her little Mideast diplomatic wife tennis circle's weekly round robin. Then hung around the special silver key members lounge with the other ladies, unwrapping her face and hair and playing Nargis and all smoking kiff and making extremely delicate and oblique fun of their husbands' sexual idiosyncrasies, laughing softly with their hands over their mouths.
11.
The medical attaché at their apartment is still viewing the unlabeled cartridge, which he has rewound to the beginning several times, and then configured for a recursive loop. He sits there, attached to a congealed supper, watching, at 0020 hours, having now wet both his pants and the special recliner. 18 in May, Mario Incandenza's designated function around Enfield Tennis Academy is filmic. Sometimes during AM drills or PM matches, he'll be assigned by Coach Stitt et al. To set up an old camcorder, or whatever video stuff's to hand, on a tripod and record a certain area of court, videotaping different kids' strokes, footwork, certain ticks and hitches and serves or running volleys, so the staff can show the tapes to the kids instructionally, letting the kids see on the screen exactly what a coach or pro-rector's talking about. The reason being, it's a lot easier to fix something if you can see it. Autumn. Year of dairy products from the American heartland. Drug addicts, driven to crime, to finance their drug addiction, are not often inclined toward violent crime. Violence requires all different kinds of energy, and most drug addicts like to expend their energy not on their professional crime, but on what their professional crime lets them afford. Drug addicts are often burglars, therefore. One reason why the home of someone whose home has been burglarized feels violated and unclean is that there have probably been drug addicts in there. Don Gately was a 27-year-old oral narcotics addict, favoring Demerol and Toluene.
12.
And a more or less professional burglar. And he was, himself, unclean and violated. But he was a gifted burglar when he burgled, though the size of a young dinosaur, with a massive and almost perfectly square head, He used to amuse his friends when drunk by letting them open and close elevator doors on. He was, at his professional zenith, smart, sneaky, quiet, quick, possessed of good taste and reliable transportation, with a kind of ferocious jolliness in his attitude toward his livelihood. As an active drug addict, Gately was distinguished by his ferocious and jolly elan. He kept his big square chin up and his smile wide, but he bowed neither toward nor away from any man. He took zero in the way of shit, and was a cheery but implacable exponent of the "don't get mad, get even" school. Like, for instance, once, after he'd done a really unpleasant 3-month bit in Revere holding on nothing more than a remorseless North Shore assistant district attorney's circumstantial suspicion, finally getting out after 92 days when his PD got the charges dismissed on a right to speedy brief, Gately and a trusted associate paid a semi-professional visit to the private home of this assistant DA, whose zeal and warrant had cost Gately a nasty impromptu detox on the floor of his little holding cell.
13.
Also a believer in the revenge is tastier chilled dictum, Gately had waited patiently until the Eye on People section of the Globe mentioned the ADA and his wife's presence at some celebrity charity sailing thing out in Marblehead. Gately and the associate went that night to the ADA's private home in the upscale Wonderland Valley section of Revere, killed the power to the home with a straight shunt in the meter's inflow, then clipped just the ground wire on the home's pricey HBT alarm, so that the alarm would sound after 10 or so minutes and create the impression that the perps had somehow bungled the alarm and been scared off in the middle of the act. Later that night, when Revere's and Marblehead's finest summoned them home, the ADA and his wife found themselves minus a coin collection and two antique shotguns and nothing more. Quite a few other valuables were stacked on the floor of the living room off the foyer, like the perps hadn't had time to get them out of the house. Everything else in the burglarized home looked undisturbed. The ADA was a jaded pro. He walked around touching the brim of his hat and reconstructed probable events.
14.
The perps looked like they'd bungled, disabling the alarm all the way, and had got scared off by the thing's siren when the alarm's pricey HBT alternate ground kicked in at 300 volts. The ADA soothed his wife's sense of violation and uncleanliness. He calmly insisted on sleeping there in their home that very night. No hotel. It was, like, crucial to get right back on the emotional horse in cases like this, he insisted. And then the next day, the ADA worked out the insurance and reported the shotguns to a buddy at ATF, and his wife calmed down, and life went on.
15.
About a month later, an envelope arrived in the ADA's home's exquisite wrought iron mailbox. In the envelope were a standard American Dental Association glossy brochure on the importance of daily oral hygiene, available at, like, any dentist's office anywhere, and two high-pixel Polaroid snapshots, one of Big Don Gately and one of his associate, each in a Halloween mask, denoting a clown's great good professional cheer, each with his pants down and bent over, and each with the enhanced focus handle of one of the couple's toothbrushes protruding from his bottom. Don Gately had sense enough never to work the North Shore again after that, but he ended up in hideous trouble anyway, ADA-wise. It was either bad luck or kismet or so forth. It was because of a cold, a plain old human rhinovirus. And not even Don Gately's cold is what made him finally stop and question his kismet. The thing started out looking like tit on a tray, burglary-wise. A beautiful neo-Georgian home in a wildly upscale part of Brookline was set nicely back from an unlit pseudo-rural road, had a chintzy Centrico alarm system that fed, idiotically enough, on a whole separate 330-volt AC 90-hertz cable with its own meter. Didn't seem to be on anything like a regular PM patrol route, and had, at its rear, flimsily tasteful French doors, surrounded by dense and thorn-free, deciduous shrubbery, and blocked off from the garage's halogen floods by a private EWD-issue, upscale dumpster. It was, in short, a real cocktease of a home, burglary-wise, for a drug addict. And Don Gately straight shunted the alarms meter and, with an associate, broke and entered and crept around on huge cat feet.
16.
Except, unfortunately, the owner of the house turned out to be still home, even though both of his cars and the rest of his family were gone. The little guy was asleep, sick in bed upstairs, in acetate pajamas, with a hot water bottle on his chest, and half a glass of OJ, and a bottle of NyQuil, and a foreign book, and copies of International Affairs and Interdependent Affairs, and a pair of thick specs, and an industrial-sized box of Kleenex on the bedside table, and an empty vaporizer barely humming at the foot of the bed. And the guy was, to say the least, nonplussed, to wake up and see high-filter flashlights crisscrossing over the unlit bedroom walls and bureau, antique chiffonier, as Gately and associates scanned for a wall safe, which, surprisingly, like 90% of people with wall safes, conceal in their master bedroom behind some sort of land or seascape painting.
17.
People turned out so identical in certain root domestic particulars it made Gately feel strange sometimes, like he was in possession of certain over-large private facts to which no man should be entitled. Gately had a way stickier conscience about the possession of some of these large particular facts than he did about making off with other people's personal merchandise. But then, all of a sudden, in mid-silent search for a safe, here's this upscale homeowner turning out to be home with a nasty head cold while his family's out on a two-car foliage tour in what's left of the Berkshires, writhing groggily and NyQuilized around on the bed, and making honking adenoidal sounds, and asking what in bloody hell is the meaning of this, except he's saying it in Quebecois French, which means to these thuggish U.S. drug addicts in Halloween clowns' masks exactly nothing. He's sitting up in bed, a little and older-type homeowner with a football-shaped head and gray Van Dyke, and eyes you can tell are used to corrective lenses as he switches on the bright bedside lamp. Gately could easily have screwed out of there and never looked back. But here indeed, in the lamplight, is a seascape over next to the chiffonier, and the associate has a quick peek and reports that the safe behind it is to laugh at. It can be opened with harsh language, almost. And oral narcotics addicts tend to operate on an extremely rigid physical schedule of need and satisfaction, and Gately is at this moment firmly in the need part of the schedule. And so, D.W. Gately, disastrously, decides to go ahead and allow a non-violent burglary to become, in effect, a robbery, which the operative legal difference involves either violence or the coercive threat of same. And Gately draws himself up to his full menacing height and shines his flashlight in the little homeowner's roomy eyes and addresses him the way menacing criminals speak in popular entertainment. D's for T.H.'s, various apocryphes, and so on, and takes hold of the guy's ear and conducts him down to a kitchen chair and binds his arms and legs to the chair with electrical cords neatly clipped from refrigerator and can opener and M. Café brand automatic café au lait maker, binds him just short of gangrenously tight, because he's hoping the Berkshire foliage is prime, and the guy is going to be soloing in this chair for a good stretch of time, and Gately starts looking through the kitchen drawers for the silverware. Not the good silver for company silverware. That was in a calfskin case underneath some neatly folded old spare Christmas wrapping, in a stunning hardwood with ivory inlay chest of drawers in the living room, where over 90% of upscale people's good silver is always hidden, and has already been promoted and is piled just off the foyer.
18.
But just the regular old everyday flatware silverware, because the vast bulk of homeowners keep their dish towels two drawers below their everyday silverware drawer. And God's made no better call for help stifling gag in the world than a good old, oily smelling, fake linen dish towel. And the bound guy in the cords on the chair suddenly snaps to the implications of what Gately's looking for, and is struggling and saying, "Do not gag me. I have a terrible cold. My nose, she is a brick of the snot. I have not the power to breathe through the nose. For the love of God, please do not gag my mouth." And as a gesture of goodwill, the homeowner tells Gately, who's rummaging, the combination of the bedroom's seascape safe, except in French numbers, which, together with the honking adenoidal inflection the guy's grip gives his speech, doesn't even sound like human speech to Gately. But also, the guy tells Gately, there are some antique, pre-British takeover, Quebecois gold coins in a calfskin purse taped to the back of an undistinguished impressionist landscape in the living room. But everything the Canadian homeowner says means no more to poor old Don Gately, whistling a jolly tune and trying to look menacing in his clown's mask, than the cries of, say, North Shore gulls or inland grackles. And sure enough, the towels are two drawers under the spoons. And here comes Gately across the kitchen, looking like a sort of bozo from hell. And the Quebecer guy's mouth goes oval with horror, and into that mouth goes a balled-up, faintly greasy-smelling kitchen towel. And across the guy's cheeks, and over the dome of protruding linen, goes some fine-quality fibrous strapping tape from the drawer under the decommissioned phone. What does everybody keep the serious mailing supplies in the drawer nearest the kitchen phone? And Don Gately, an associate, finish their swift and with the best of intentions non-violent business of stripping the Brookline home as bare as a post-feral hamster meadow. And they relock the front door and hit the unlit road in Gately's reliable and double-mufflered 4x4. And the bound, wheezing, acetate-clad Canadian, the right-hand man to probably the most infamous anti-ONAN organizer north of the Great Concavity, the lieutenant and troubleshooting trusted advisor who selflessly volunteered to move with his family to the savagely American area of Metro Boston, to act as liaison between and general leash holder for the half-dozen or so malevolent and mutually antagonistic groups of Quebecer separatists and Albertan ultra-rightists, united only in their fanatical conviction that the USA's ex-imperialistic gift or return of the so-called reconfigured Great Convexity to its northern neighbor and ONAN ally constituted an intolerable blow to Canadian sovereignty, honor, and hygiene, this homeowner, unquestionably a VIP, although admittedly rather a covert VIP, or probably more accurately a PIT in French.
19.
This meek-looking Canadian terrorism coordinator, bound to his chair, thoroughly gagged, sitting there, alone, under cold, fluorescent kitchen lights.
20.
The rhino, virally afflicted man, gagged with skill and quality materials. The guy, having worked so hard to partially clear one clotted nasal passage that he tore intercostal ligaments in his ribs, soon found even that pinprick of air blocked off by mucus's implacable lava-like flow once again, and so has to tear more ligaments trying to breach the other nostril, and so on. And after an hour of struggle and flames in his chest and blood on his lips and the white kitchen towel from trying frantically to tongue the towel out past the tape, which is quality tape, and after hopes skyrocketing when the doorbell rings, and then hopes blackly dashed when the person at the door, a young woman with a clipboard and chewing gum who's offering promotional coupons good for happy holidays discounts on memberships of 6 months or more at a string of Boston non-UV tanning salons, shrugs in her parka and makes a mark on the clipboard and blithely retreats down the long driveway to the pseudo-rural road. An hour of this or more, finally, the Quebecois PIT, after unspeakable agony, slow suffocation, mucoidal or no, being no day at the Montreal Tulip Fest, at the height of which agony, hearing his head's pulse as receding thunder and watching his vision circles shrink as a red aperture around his sight rotates steadily in from the edges, at the height of which he could think only, despite the pain and panic, of what a truly dumb and silly way this was, after all this time, to die. A thought which the towel and tape denied expression via the rueful grin with which the best men meet the dumbest ends. This Guillaume de Plessis passed bluely from this life and sat there in the kitchen chair, 250 clicks due east of some really spectacular autumn foliage, for almost two nights and days, his posture getting more and more military as rigor mortis set in, with his bare feet looking like purple loaves of bread from the lividity. And when Brookline's finest are finally summoned and got him unbound from the coldly lit chair, they had to carry him out as if he were still seated. So militarily comme il faut had his limbs and spine hardened. And poor old Don Gately, whose professional habit of killing power with straight shunts to a meter's inflow was pretty much a signature M.O., and who had, of course, a special place in the heart of a remorseless revere with judicial clout throughout Boston's three counties and beyond, and, of course, particularly remorseless ADA as of late, whose wife now needed Valium even just to floss, and was patiently awaiting his chance, the ADA was, coldly biding his time, being a patient get-even and cold dish man just like Don Gately, who was, through no will to energy-consuming violence on his part, in the sort of a hell of a deep shit mess that can turn a man's life right around. Year of the Depend Adult Undergarment. Interlace Tell Entertainment. 932-1864. RISC. Power TPs with or without console. Pink number 2. Post Prime Star DSS dissemination. Menus and icons. Pixel-free internet fax. Tri and quad modems with adjustable baud. Dissemination grids. Screens so high def you might as well be there. Cost-effective videophonic conferencing. Internal Frox CD-ROM. Electronic couture, all-in-one consoles. You shit you nanoprocessors. Laser chromatography. Virtual capable media cards. Fiber optic pulse. Digital encoding. Killer apps. Carpal neuralgia. Phosphenic migraine. Gluteal hyperadiposity. Lumbar stressy. November 3rd. Year of the Depend Adult Undergarment. Room 204. Subdormitory B. Jim Trulch, age 17. Hometown, Narberth, Pennsylvania. Current Enfield Tennis Academy rank in boys 18s, number 8, which puts him at number 2 singles on the 18s B team. Has been taken ill. Again. It came on as he was suiting up warmly for the B-Squad's 0745 hours drills. A cartridge of a round of 16 match from September's U.S. Open had been on the small room viewer with the sound all the way down, as usual, and Trulch had been straightening the straps on his jock, idly calling the match's action into his fist when it came on. The illness. It came out of nowhere. His breathing all of a sudden started hurting the back of his throat. Then that overfull heat in various cranial meatus. Then he squeezed, and the stuff he sneezed out was thick and doughy. It came on ultra-fast and out of the pre-drill blue. He's back in bed now, supine, watching the match's fourth set but not calling the action. The viewers, right under Pemulis's poster of the Paranoid King, that you can't escape looking at, if you want to look at the viewer.
21.
Clotted Kleenex litter the floor around his bed's wastebasket. The bedside table is littered with both OTC and prescription expectorants, and pertussives, and analgesics, and vitamin C megaspansules, and one bottle of Benadryl and one of Seldane.
22.
Only the Seldane bottle actually contains several tenuate 75 milligram capsules Trulch has incrementally promoted from Pemulis's part of the room. It has, rather ingeniously, he thinks, stashed in bold, plain sight, in a bedside pill bottle, where the peemster, would never think to check. Trolch is the sort that can feel his own forehead and detect fever. It's definitely a rhinovirus, the sudden severe kind. He speculated on if yesterday, when Graham Rader pretended to sneeze on J. Trolch's lunch tray, at the milk dispenser at lunch, if Rader might have really sneezed, and only pretended to pretend, transferring virulent rhinoviri to Trolch's delicate mucosa. He feverishly, mentally calls down various cosmic retributions on Rader. Neither of Trolch's roommates is here. Ted Schacht is getting the knees first of several whirlpools for the day. Pemulus has geared up and left for 0745 drills. Trolch offered Pemulus rights to his breakfast to fill up his vaporizer for him and call the first shift nurse for yet more Seldane nuclear-grade antihistamine and a dextromethorphan nebulizer and a written excuse from AM drills. He lies there sweating freely, watching digitally recorded professional tennis, too worried about his throat to feel loquacious enough to call the action. Seldane is not supposed to make you drowsy, but he feels weak and unpleasantly drowsy. He can barely make a fist. He's sweaty. Nausea slash vomiting like not an impossibility by any means. He cannot believe how fast it came on, the illness. The vaporizer seethes and burps, and all four of the room's windows weep against the outside cold. There are the sad, tiny, distant champagne cork sounds of scores of balls being hit down at the east courts. Trolch drifts at a level just above sleep. Enormous ATH-SCME, displacement fans far up north at the wall, and Border's distant roar, and the outdoor voices and pock of cold balls create a kind of sound carpet below the digestive sounds of the vaporizer and the squeak of Trolch's bedsprings as he thrashes and twitches in a moist half-sleep. He has heavy German eyebrows and big knuckled hands. It's one of those unpleasant opioid feverish half-sleep states, more a fugue state than a sleep state, less a floating than like being cast adrift on rough seas, tossed mightily in and out of this half-sleep, where your mind's still working, and you can ask yourself whether you're asleep even as you dream. And any dreams you do have seem ragged at the edges, gnawed on, incomplete. It's literally daydreaming. Sick, the kind of incomplete fugue you awake from with a sort of psychic clunk, struggling up to sit upright, convinced there's someone unauthorized in the dorm room with you. Falling back sick on his circle-stained pillow, staring straight up into the prolix folds of the Turkish blanketish thing Pemulous and Schacht had crazy glued to the ceiling's corners, which billows, hanging, so its folds form a terrain, like with valleys and shadows. I am coming to see that the sensation of the worst nightmares, a sensation that can be felt asleep or awake, is identical to those worst dreams form itself. The sudden intra-dream realization that the nightmare's very essence and center has been with you all along, even awake. It's just been overlooked. And then that horrific interval between realizing that you've overlooked and turning your head to look back at what's been right there, all along, the whole time. Your first nightmare away from home and folks. Your first night at the academy. It was there all along. The dream is that you awaken from a deep sleep, wake up suddenly damp and panicked, and are overwhelmed with the sudden feeling that there is a distillation of total evil in this dark, strange sub-dorm room with you. That evil's essence and center is right here in this room right now, and is for you alone. None of the other little boys in the room are awake. The bunk above yours sags, dead, motionless. No one moves. No one else in the room feels the presence of something radically evil. None thrash or sit damply up. No one else cries out. Whatever it is not evil for them. The flashlight your mother name-tagged with masking tape and packed for you special hands around the institutional room. The drop ceiling, the gray striped mattress, and bulged grid of bunk springs above you. The two other bunk beds, another matte gray that won't return light. The piles of books and compact discs and tapes and tennis gear. Your disc of white light trembling like the moon on water as it plays over the identical bureaus. The recessions of closet and room's front door. Doors, frames, belections. The cone of light pans over fixtures. The lumpy jumbles of sleeping boys' shadows on the snuff-white walls. The two rag throw rugs ovals on the hardwood floor. Black lines of baseboards reglets. The cracks in the Venetian blinds that ooze the violet non-light of a night with snow and just a hook of moon. The flashlight with your name in maternal cursive plays over every centimeter of the walls. The rheostats. CD. Interlaced poster of Tony Kondo. Phone console, desks, TPs, the face in the floor, posters of prose, the onion skin yellow of the desk lamp's shades, the ceiling panel's patterns of pinholes, the grid of upper bunk's springs, recession of closet and door, boys wrapped in blankets, slight crack like a creek's course in the eastward ceiling, discernible now, maple reglet border at seam of ceiling, and walls north and south. No floor has a face. Your flashlight showed, but didn't know, never did see its eyes, pupils set sideways and tapered like a cat's, its eyebrows V and the horrid toothy smile leering right at your light all the time you've been scanning. Oh, mother, a face in the floor. Mother, oh! And your flashlight's beam stabs jaggedly back for the overlooked face, misses it, overcorrects, then centers on what you'd felt but had seen without seeing just now, as you'd so carefully panned the light and looked, a face in the floor there all the time but unfelt by all others, and unseen by you until you knew just as you felt it didn't belong and was evil. Evil. And then its mouth opens at your light. And then you wake like that, quivering like a struck drum. Lying there awake and quivering, summoning courage and spit, roll to the right just as in the dream for the name-tagged flashlight on the floor by the bed just in case, lie there on your shank and side, shining the light all over just as in the dream, lie there panning, looking, all ribs and elbows and dilated eyes. The awake floor is littered with gear and dirty clothes, blonde hardwood with sealed seams, two throw rugs, the bare waxed wood shiny in the window's snowlight, the floor neutral, faceless. You cannot see any face in the floor. Awake, lying there, faceless, blank, dilated, playing beam over floor again and again, not sure all night, forever, unsure you're not missing something that's right there. You lie there, awake, at almost 12, believing with all your might. As of Year of the Depend Adult Undergarment. The Enfield Tennis Academy has been in accredited operation for 3 pre-subsidized years, and then 8 subsidized years. First under the direction of Dr. James Incandenza, and then under the administration of his half-brother-in-law, Charles Tavis, educationist director. James Orrin Incandenza, the only child of a former top U.S. junior tennis player, and then promising young pre-method actor who, during the interval of J.O. Incandenza's early formative years, had become a disrespected and largely unemployable actor, driven back to his native Tucson, Arizona, and dividing his remaining energies between stints as a tennis pro at ranch-type resorts, and then short-run productions at something called the Desert Beat Theater Project. The father, a dipsomaniacal tragedian, progressively crippled by obsessions with death, by spider bite, and by stage fright, and with a bitterness of ambiguous origin but consuming intensity toward the method school of professional acting and its more promising exponents. A father who, somewhere around the nadir of his professional fortunes, apparently decided to go down to his raid-sprayed basement workshop and build a promising junior athlete, the way other fathers might restore vintage autos, or build ships inside bottles, or, like, refinish chairs, etc. James and Condenza proved a withdrawn but compliant student of the game, and soon a gifted junior player. Tall, bespectacled, domineering at net, who used tennis scholarships to finance on his own private secondary and then higher education at places just about as far away from the U.S. Southwest as one could get without drowning. The United States government's prestigious ONR financed his doctorate in optical physics, fulfilling something of a childhood dream.
23.
His strategic value, during the federal interval, G. Ford to early G. Bush, as more or less the top applied geometrical optics man in the ONR and SAC, designing neutron-scattering reflectors for thermostrategic weapons systems, then in the Atomic Energy Commission, where his development of gamma-refractive indices for lithium-anodized lenses and panels is commonly regarded as one of the big half-dozen discoveries that made possible cold annular fusion and approximate energy independence for the U.S. and its various allies and protectorates. His optical acumen translated, after an early retirement from the public sector, into a patented fortune in rear-view mirrors, light-sensitive eyewear, holographic birthday and Christmas greeting cartridges, videophonic tableau, homolocine cartography software, non-fluorescent public lighting systems, and film equipment. Then, in the optative retirement from hard science that building and opening a USTA-accredited and pedagogically experimental tennis academy apparently represented for him, into avant-garde experimental and conceptual film work, too far either ahead of or behind its time, possibly, to be much appreciated at the time of his death in the year of the trial-sized Dove Bar. Although a lot of it, the experimental and conceptual film work, was admittedly just plain pretentious and unengaging and bad, and probably not helped at all by the man's very gradual spiral into the crippling dipsomania of his late father.
24.
The tall, ungainly, socially challenged, and hard-drinking Dr. Incandenza's May-December marriage to one of the few bona fide bombshell-type females in North American academia, the extremely tall and high-strung but also extremely pretty and gainly and teetotaling and classy Dr. Avril Mondragon.
25.
The only female academic ever to hold the McDonald Chair in prescriptive usage at the Royal Victoria College of McGill University, whom Incandenza met at a U Toronto conference on reflective versus reflexive systems, was rendered even more romantic by the bureaucratic tribulations involved in obtaining an exit and then an entrance visa, to say nothing of a green card. For even a U.S.-spoused Professor Mondragon, whose involvement, however demonstrably nonviolent, with certain members of the Quebecois separatist left, while in graduate school, had placed her name on the RCMP's notorious Personne à qui en doit surveiller attentivement list. The birth of the Incandenza's first child, Oren, had been at least partly a legal maneuver. It is known that during the last 5 years of his life, Dr. James O. Incandenza liquidated his assets and patent licenses, ceded control over most of the Enfield Tennis Academy's operations to his wife's half-brother, a former engineer most recently employed in amateur sports administration at Throppinghamshire Provincial College, New Brunswick, Canada, and devoted his unimpaired hours, almost exclusively, to the production of documentaries, technically recondite art films, and mordantly obscure and obsessive dramatic cartridges, leaving behind a substantial, given the late age at which he bloomed creatively, number of completed films and cartridges, some of which have earned a small academic following for their technical feck and for a pathos that was somehow both surreally abstract and CNS-rendingly melodramatic at the same time. Professor James O. Incandenza, Jr.'s untimely suicide at 54 was held a great loss in at least three worlds. President J. Gentle, F.C., acting on behalf of the USDD's ONR and ONAN's post-annular AEC, conferred a posthumous citation and conveyed his condolences by classified ARPANET electronic mail. Incandenza's burial in Quebec's Lillet County was twice delayed by annular hyperfloration cycles. Cornell University Press announced plans for a Festschrift. Certain leading young, quote, avant-garde and anti-confluential filmmakers employed in their output for the year of the trial-sized Dubbar certain oblique visual gestures, most involving the chiaroscuro lamping and custom lens effects for which Incandenza's distinctive deep focus was known, that paid the sort of deep insider's elegiac tribute no audience could be expected to notice. An interview with Incandenza was posthumously included in a book on the genesis of annulation, and those of ETA's junior players, whose hypertrophied arms could fit inside them, wore black armbands on court for almost a year. Denver, Colorado. The 1st of November, year of the Depend adult undergarment. I hate this! Orin yells out to whoever glides near. He doesn't loop or spiral like the showboats. He sort of tacks, the gliding equivalent of snow plowing, unspectacular, and aiming to get it over ASAP and intact. The fake red wings nylon platters in an updraft. Ill-glued feathers keep peeling off and rising. The updraft is the oxides from mile-high's thousands of open mouths. Far and away the loudest stadium anyplace, he feels like a dick. The beak makes it hard to breathe and see. Two reverse ends do some kind of combined barrel roll thing. The worst is the moment right before they make the jump off the stadium's rim. Hands in the top rows reaching and clutching. People laughing. The interlaced cameras panning and tightening. Orin knows too well the light on the side that means zoom. Once they're out over the field, the voices melt and merge into oxides and updraft. The left guard is soaring up instead of down. A couple beaks and a claw fall off somebody and go pinwheeling down toward the green. Orin tacks grimly back and forth. He's among those who steadfastly refuse to whistle or squawk. Bonus or no. The stadium's loudspeakers, a steely gargle. You could never hear it clearly, even on the ground. The sad old ex-quarterback who now just holds on place kicks falls in beside Orin's slow back and forth, about 100 meters over the 40. He's one of the token females, his beak blunter and wings red, non-garish. Hate and loathe this with a cluster fucking passion, Clate! The holder tries to make a resigned wing gesture and is almost blown into Orin's pin feathers. Almost down! Enjoy the ride! Yo, cleavage check in 22G, just by the... And then lost in the roar, as the first player touches down and sheds the red-feathered promotional apparatus. You had to scream to even be heard. At some point it starts sounding like the crowd's roaring at its own roar, a doubling back quality like something'll blow. One of the Broncos in the rear end of a costume takes a header at midfield so it looks like the thing's ass went flying off. Orin has told no cardinal, not even his team's counselor and visualization therapist, about his morbid fear of heights and high-altitude descent. I punt! I'm paid! To punt long, high, well, and always. Making me do personal interviews on my personal side's bad enough. But this crosses every line. Why do we stand for this? I'm an athlete. I'm not a freak show performer. Nobody mentioned flying at the trade table. In New Orleans, it was just robes and halos, and once a season, a zither. But just once a season. This is fucking awful! Could be worse. Spiraling down toward the line of X's and the bill-capped guys that help strip the wings off, runty, pot-bellied volunteer front office connected guys, who always smirk in a way you couldn't quite level the accusation. I'm paid to punt! It's worse in Philly. Had fucking water drops in Seattle for 3 seasons. Please, Lord, spare the leg, Oren whispers each time just before touchdown. Of how you could be an Oiler. You could be a Brown. The organo-psychedelic muscimol, an isoxazole alkaloid derived from Amanita muscaria, a.k.a. the fly agaric mushroom. By no means, Michael Pamulis emphasizes, to be confused with phalloids or verna or certain other kill-you-dead species of North America's Amanita genus. As the little kids sit there Indian-style on the viewing room floor, glassy-eyed and trying not to yawn, goes by the structural moniker 5-aminomethyl-3-isoxazole. Requires about like maybe 10 to 20 oral milligrams per ingestion, making it 2 to 3 times as potent as psilocybin, and frequently results in the following alterations in consciousness, not reading or referring to notes in any way. A kind of semi-sleep-like trance with visions, elation, sensations of physical lightness, and increased strength, heightened sensual perceptions, synesthesia, and favorable distortions in body image. This is supposed to be a pre-dinner Big Buddy powwow, where the littler kids receive general big brotherly-type support and counsel from an upperclassman. Pamulis sometimes treats his group's powwows like a kind of colloquium, sharing personal findings and interests. The viewers, on read from the room's laptop, and the screen's got block-capitaled methoxylated bases for phenylkylamine manipulation on it, and underneath some stuff that might as well be Greek to the little buds. Two of the kids squeeze tennis balls. Two rock and bob, hasidically, to stay alert. One has a hat with a pair of fake antennae made of tight-coiled spring. More or less revered by the aboriginal tribes of what's now southern Quebec and the Great Concavity, Pamulis tells them, the fly agaric shroom was both loved and hated for its powerful but not always, unless carefully titrated, pleasant psycho-spiritual effects. A boy probes at his own navel with great interest. Another pretends to fall over. Some of the more marginal players start in as early as maybe 12, I'm sorry to say, particularly dreens before matches and then enkephalin after.
26.
Which can generate a whole vicious circle of individual neurochemistry. But I myself, having taken certain vows early on concerning fathers and differences, didn't even get downwind of my first bit of bop hope until 15, more likely near 16, when Bridget Boone, in whose room a lot of the 16 and unders used to congregate before lights out, invited me to consider a couple of late-night bongs as a kind of psychodysleptic somnex to help me sleep, perhaps finally, all the way through a really unpleasant dream that had been recurring nightly and waking me up in medias for weeks and was beginning to grind me down and to cause some slight deterioration in performance and rank. Low-grade synthetic bob or not, the bongs worked like a charm.
27.
In this dream, which every now and then still recurs, I am standing publicly at the baseline of a gargantuan tennis court. I'm in a competitive match, clearly. There are spectators, officials. The court is about the size of a football field, though, maybe, it seems. It's hard to tell. But mainly the court's complex. The lines that bound and define play are on this court as complex and convolved as a sculpture of string. There are lines going every which way, and they run oblique or meet and form relationships and boxes and rivers and tributaries and systems inside systems. Lines, corners, alleys, and angles deliquesce into a blur at the horizon of the distant net. I stand there tentatively. The whole thing is almost too involved to try to take in all at once. It's simply huge and public. A silent crowd resolves itself at what may be the court's periphery, dressed in summer's citrus colors, motionless and highly attentive. A battalion of linesmen stand blandly alert in their blazers and safari hats, hands folded over their slacks flies. High overhead, Near what might be a net post, the umpire, blue-blazered, wired for amplification in his tall high chair, whispers, "Play." The crowd is a tableau, motionless and attentive. I twirl my stick in my hand and bounce a fresh yellow ball and try to figure out where in all that mess of lines I'm supposed to direct service. I can make out in the stand stage left the white sun umbrella of the moms. Her height raises the white umbrella above her neighbors. She sits in her small circle of shadow, hair white and legs crossed and a delicate fist upraised and tight in total unconditional support. The umpire whispers, "Please play." We sort of play. But it's all hypothetical somehow. Even the "we" is theory. I never get quite to see the distant opponent for all the apparatus of the game. Year of the Depend Adult Undergarment. Doctors tend to enter the arenas of their profession's practice with a brisk good cheer that they have to then stop and try to mute a bit when the arena they're entering is a hospital's fifth floor, a psych ward, where brisk good cheer would amount to a kind of gloating. This is why doctors on psych wards so often wear a vaguely fake frown of puzzled concentration, if and when you see them in fifth-floor halls. And this is why a hospital MD, who's usually hale and pink-cheeked and poreless, and who almost always smells unusually clean and good, approaches any psych patient under his care with a professional manner somewhere between bland and deep, a distant but sincere concern that's divided evenly between the patient's subjective discomfort and the hard facts of the case. The doctor who poked his fine head just inside her hot room's open door and knocked maybe a little too gently on the metal jamb found Kate Gompert lying on her side on the slim hard bed in blue jeans and a sleeveless blouse with her knees drawn up to her abdomen and her fingers laced around her knees. Something almost too overt about the pathos of the posture, this exact position was illustrated in some melancholic Watteau-era print on the frontispiece to Yevtushchenko's Field Guide to Clinical States. Kate Gompert wore dark blue boating sneakers without socks or laces, half her face obscured by the either green or yellow case on the plastic pillow, her hair so long unwashed it had separated into discrete shiny strands, and black bangs lay like a cell's glossy bars across the visible half of her forehead. The psych ward smelled faintly of disinfectant, and the community lounge's cigarette smoke, the sour odor of medical waste awaiting collection with also that perpetual slight ammoniac tang of urine. And there was the double bing of the elevator, and the always faraway sound of the intercom paging some MD, and some high-volume cursing from a manic in the pink quiet room at the other end of the psych ward hall from the community lounge. Kate Gompert's room also smelled of singed dust from the heat vent, also of the oversweet perfume worn by the young mental health staffer who sat in a chair at the foot of the girl's bed, chewing blue gum and viewing a soundless ROM cartridge on a ward-issue laptop. Kate Gompert was on specials, which meant suicide watch, which meant that the girl had at some point betrayed both ideation and intent, which meant she had to be watched right up close by a staffer 24 hours a day until the supervising MD called off the specials. Staffers rotated specials duty every hour, ostensibly so that whoever was on duty was always fresh and keenly observant, but really because simply sitting there at the foot of a bed looking at somebody who was in so much psychic pain she wanted to commit suicide, was incredibly depressing and boring and unpleasant. So they spread the odious duty out as thin as they possibly could, the staffers. They were not technically supposed to read, do paperwork, view CD-ROMs, do personal grooming, or in any way divert their attention from the patient on specials on duty. The patient, Ms. Gompert, seemed both to be fighting for breath and to be breathing rapidly enough to induce hypocapnia. The doctor could not be expected not also to notice that she had fairly large breasts that rose and fell rapidly inside the circle of arms with which she hugged her knees. The girl's eyes, which were dull, had registered his appearance in the doorway, but they didn't seem to track as he came toward the bed. The staffer was also employing an emery board. The doctor told the staffer that he was going to need a few moments alone with Ms. Gompert. It is a sort of requirement that a doctor, whenever possible, be reading or at least looking down at something on his clipboard when addressing a subordinate. So the doctor was looking studiously at the patient's intake and the sheaf of charts and records Med netted over from trauma and psych wards in some other city hospitals. Gompert, Catherine A., 21, Newton, Massachusetts. Dead a clerical in a Wellesley Hills real estate office. Fourth hospitalization in 3 years. All clinical depression. Unipolar. One series of electroconvulsive treatments out at Newton Wellesley Hospital 2 years back. On Prozac for a short time. Then Zoloft. Most recently, Parnate, with a lithium kicker. Two previous suicide attempts. The second just this past summer. Bivalium discontinued 2 years. Xanax discontinued 1 year. An admitted history of abusing prescribed meds. Depression's unipolar, fairly classic, characterized by acute dysphoria, anxiety with panic, diurnal listlessness / agitation patterns. Ideation with and without intent. First attempt at CO episode, garage's automobile had stalled before lethal hemotoxicity achieved. Then last year's attempt, no scarring now visible, her wrists, vascular nodes obscured by the insides of the knees she held. She continued to stare at the doorway where he'd first appeared. This latest attempt, a straightforward meds OD. Admitted via the ER 3 nights past. 2 days on ventilation after a pump and purge. Hypertensive crisis on the second day from metabolic retox. She must have taken a hell of a lot of meds. The ICU charge nurse had beat the chaplain, so the retox must have been bad. Almost died twice this time, Catherine Ann Gompert. Third day spent on 2 West for observation. Librium reluctantly administered for a BP that was all over the map. Now, here on 5, his present arena. BP stable, as of the last 4 readings. Next vitals at 1300 hours. The attempt had been serious. A real attempt. This girl had not been futzing around. A bona fide clinical admit right out of Yevtushchenko or Dretsky. Over half the admits to psych wards are things like cheerleaders who swallow 2 bottles of Midol over a high school breakup, or gray, lonely, asexual, depressing people rendered inconsolable by the death of a pet. The cathartic trauma of actually going in somewhere officially psych, some understanding nods, some bare indication somebody gives half a damn, they rally. Back out they go. 3 determined attempts in a course of shock spelled no such case here. The doctor's interior state was somewhere between trepidation and excitement, which manifested outwardly as a sort of blandly deep, puzzled concern. The doctor said hi, and that he wanted to ascertain for sure that she was Catherine Gompert, as they hadn't met before up till now. "That's me," in a bit of a bitter sing-song. Her voice was oddly lit up for one who lay fetal, dead-eyed, without facial affect. The doctor said could she tell him a little bit about why she's here with them right now? Can she remember back to what happened? She took an even deeper breath. She was attempting to communicate boredom or irritation. "I took 110 Parnate, about 30 Lithonate capsules, some old Zoloft. I took everything I had in the world."
"You really must have wanted to hurt yourself, then, it seems."
"They said downstairs the Parnate made me black out. I did a blood pressure thing. My mother heard noises upstairs and found me," she said, "down on my side, chewing the rug in my room. My room's shag carpeted." She said I was on the floor, flushed red and all wet, like when I was a newborn. She said she thought at first she hallucinated me as a newborn again. On my side, all red and wet.
A hypertensive crisis will do that. It means your blood pressure was high enough to have killed you. Sertraline in combination with an MAOI will kill you in enough quantities.
28.
And with the toxicity of that much lithium besides, I'd say you're pretty lucky to be here right now.
My mother sometimes thinks she's hallucinating.
Sertraline, by the way, is the Zoloft you kept instead of discarding as instructed when changing medications.
She says I chewed a big hole out of the carpet, but who can say? The doctor chose his second finest pen from the array in his white coat's breast pocket and made some sort of note on Kate Gompert's new chart for this particular psych ward. Crowded in among his pockets' pens was the rubber head of a diagnostic plexer. He asked Kate if she could tell him why she had wanted to hurt herself. Had she been angry at herself? At someone else? Had she ceased to feel as though her life had meaning to it? Had she heard anything like voices suggesting that she hurt herself? There was no audible response. The girl's breathing had slowed to just rapid. The doctor took an early clinical gamble and asked Kate whether it might not be easier if she rolled over and sat up so that they could speak with each other more normally, face to face. I am sitting up.
The doctor's pen was poised. His slow nod was studious, blandly puzzled-seeming.
You mean to say you feel right now as if your body is already in a sitting-up position?
She rolled an eye up at him for a long moment, sighed meaningfully, and rolled and rose. Catherine Ann Gompert probably felt that here was yet another psych ward MD with zero sense of humor. This was probably because she did not understand the strict methodological limits that dictated how literal he, a doctor, had to be with the admits on the psych ward, nor that jokes and sarcasm were here usually too pregnant and fertile with clinical significance not to be taken seriously. Sarcasm and jokes were often the bottle in which clinical depressives sent out their most plangent screams for someone to care and help them. The doctor, who by the way wasn't an MD yet, but a resident, here on a 12-week psych rotation, indulged this clinical reverie while the patient made an elaborate show of getting the thin pillow out from under her and leaning it up the tall way against the bare wall behind the bed and slumping back against it, her arms crossed over her breasts. The doctor decided that her open display of irritation with him could signify either a positive thing or nothing at all. Kate Gompert stared at a point over the man's left shoulder.
I wasn't trying to hurt myself. I was trying to kill myself. There's a difference.
The doctor asked whether she could try to explain what she felt the difference was between those two things. The delay that preceded her reply was only marginally longer than the pause in a regular civilian conversation. The doctor had no ideas about what this observation might indicate.
Do you guys see different kinds of suicides?
The resident made no attempt to ask Kate Gompert what she meant. She used one finger to remove some material from the corner of her mouth.
I think there must be probably different types of suicides.
I'm not one of the self-hating ones, the type of, like, I'm shit and the world would be better off without poor me type that says that, but also imagines what everybody will say at their funeral. I've met types like that on wards. Poor me, I hate me, punish me, come to my funeral.
Then they show you a 20x25 glossy of their dead cat.
It's all self-pity bullshit.
It's bullshit.
I didn't have any special grudges. I didn't fail an exam or get dumped by anybody. All these types hurt themselves. Still, that intriguing, unsettling combination of blank facial masking and conventionally animated vocal tone. The doctor's small nods were designed to appear not as responses, but as invitations to continue. What Dretzky called momentumizers.
I didn't want to especially hurt myself, or like, punish. I don't hate myself. I just wanted out. I didn't want to play anymore, is all.
Play. Nodding in confirmation, making small quick notes.
I wanted to just stop being conscious. I'm a whole different type. I wanted to stop feeling this way. If I could have just put myself in a really long coma, I would have done that. Or given myself a shock, I would have done that instead. The doctor was writing with great industry. The last thing more I'd want is hurt. I just don't want to feel this way anymore. I didn't believe this feeling would ever go away. I don't. I still don't. I'd rather feel nothing than this.
The doctor's eyes appeared keenly interested in an abstract way. They looked severely magnified behind his attractive but thick glasses, the frames of which were steel. Patients on other floors during other rotations had sometimes complained that they sometimes felt like something in a jar he was studying intently through all that thick glass. He was saying, "This feeling of wanting to stop feeling by dying, then, is..." The way she suddenly shook her head was vehement, exasperated.
"The feeling is why I want to. The feeling is the reason I want to die. I'm here because I want to die. That's why I'm in a room without windows and with cages over the light bulbs and no lock on the toilet door. Why they took my shoelaces and my belt. But I notice they don't take away the feeling, do they?"
"Is the feeling you're explaining something you've experienced in your other depressions, then, Catherine?"
The patient didn't respond right away. She slid her foot out of her shoes and touched one bare foot with the toes of the other foot. Her eyes tracked this activity. The conversation seemed to have helped her focus. Like most clinically depressed patients, she appeared to function better in focused activity than in stasis. Their normal paralyzed stasis allowed these patients' own minds to chew them apart. But it was always a titanic struggle to get them to do anything to help them focus. Most residents found the fifth floor a depressing place to do a rotation.
"What I'm trying to ask, I think, is whether this feeling you're communicating is the feeling you associate with your depression."
Her gaze moved off.
"That's what you guys want to call it, I guess."
The doctor clicked his pen slowly a few times and explained that he's more interested here in what she would choose to call the feeling, since it was her feeling. The resumed study of the movement of her feet.
"When people call it that, I always get pissed off because I always think depression sounds like you just get, like, really sad. You get quiet and melancholy and just, like, sit quietly by the window, sighing or just lying around, a state of not caring about anything, a kind of blue kind of peaceful state."
She seemed to the doctor decidedly more animated now, even as she seemed unable to meet his eyes. Her respiration had sped back up. The doctor recalled classic hyperventilatory episodes being characterized by carpopedal spasms, and reminded himself to monitor the patient's hands and feet carefully during the interview for any signs of tetanic contraction, in which case the prescribed therapy would be IV calcium in a saline percentage he would need quickly to look up.
"Well, this," she gestured at herself, "isn't a state. This is a feeling. I feel it all over. In my arms and legs."
"That would include your hands and feet?"
"All over. My head, throat, butt, and my stomach, it's all over everywhere. I don't know what I could call it. It's like I can't get enough outside it to call it anything. It's like horror more than sadness. It's more like horror. It's like something horrible is about to happen. The most horrible thing you can imagine. No, worse than you could imagine, because there's the feeling that there's something you have to do right away to stop it, but you don't know what it is you have to do, and then it's happening, too, and the whole horrible time, it's about to happen, and also it's happening all at the same time."
"So you'd say anxiety is a big part of your depressions?"
It was now not clear whether she was responding to the doctor or not.
"Everything gets horrible. Everything you see gets ugly. Lurid is the word. Dr. Garden said lurid one time. That's the right word for it. And everything sounds harsh, spiny and harsh-sounding. Like every sound you hear all of a sudden has teeth, and smelling like I smelled bad even after I just got out of the shower. It's like, what's the point of washing if everything smells like I need another shower? The doctor looked intrigued rather than concerned for a moment as he wrote all this down. He preferred handwritten notes to a laptop because he felt MDs who typed into their laps during clinical interviews gave a cold impression. Kate Gompert's face writhed for a moment while the doctor was writing.
I feel this fear more than I fear anything, man. More than pain, or my mom dying, or environmental toxicity. Anything.
Fear is a major part of anxiety, the doctor confirmed.
Catherine Gompert seemed to come out of her dark reverie for a moment. She stared full frontal at the doctor for several seconds. And the doctor, who'd had all discomfort at being stared at by patients trained right out of him when he'd rotated through the paralysis plegia wards upstairs, was able to look directly back at her with a kind of bland compassion, the expression of someone who was compassionate but was not, of course, feeling what she was feeling, and who honored her subjective feelings by not even trying to pretend that he was, sharing them. The young woman's expression in turn revealed that she had decided to take what amounted for her to her own gamble, this early in a therapeutic relationship. The abstract resolve on her face now duplicated what had been on the doctor's face when he'd taken the gamble of asking her to sit up straight.
Listen, she said. Have you ever felt sick? I mean nauseous, like you knew you were going to throw up?
The doctor made a gesture like, well, sure.
But that's just in your stomach, Kate Gompert said. It's a horrible feeling, but it's just in your stomach. That's why the term is sick to your stomach.
She was back to looking intently at her lower carpopetals.
What I told Dr. Garten is okay, but imagine if you felt that way all over inside. All through you. Like every cell and every atom or brain cell or whatever was so nauseous it wanted to throw up, but it couldn't. And you felt that way all the time. And you're sure, you're positive, the feeling will never go away. You're going to spend the rest of your natural life feeling like this.
The doctor wrote down something much too brief to correspond directly to what she'd said. He was nodding both while he wrote and when he looked up.
And yet this nauseated feeling has come and gone for you in the past. It's passed eventually during prior depressions, Catherine, has it not?
But when you're in the feeling, you forget. The feeling feels like it's always been there, and will always be there, and you forget. It's like this whole filter drops down over the whole way you think about everything. A couple of weeks after...
They sat and looked at each other. The doctor felt some combination of intense clinical excitement and anxiety about perhaps saying the wrong thing at such a crucial juncture and fouling up. His last name was needle-pointed in yellow braid on the left breast of the white coat he was required to wear.
I'm sorry, a couple weeks after...
He waited for seven breaths.
I want shock, she said finally. Isn't part of this whole concerned kindness deal that you're supposed to ask me how I think you can be of help? Because I've been through this before. You haven't asked me what I want, isn't it? Well, how about either you give me ECT again, or give me my belt back? Because I can't stand feeling like this another second, and the seconds keep coming on and on.
29.
Well, the doctor said slowly, nodding to indicate he had heard the feelings the young woman was expressing.
Well, I'm happy to discuss treatment options with you, Catherine, but I have to say right now I'm curious about what you started, it sounded like to me, to maybe start to indicate what might have occurred, something, 2 weeks ago to make you feel these feelings now.
Would you be comfortable talking to me about it?
Either ECT or you could just sedate me for a month. You could do that. All I need is, I think, a month at the outside. Like a controlled coma. You could do that if you guys want to help.
The doctor gazed at her with a patience she was meant to see. And she gave him back a frightening smile. A smile empty of all effect. as if someone had contracted her circumorals with a thigmotactic electrode. The teeth of the smile evidenced a clinical depressive's classic inattention to oral hygiene. She said, "I was thinking I was about to say, you'll think I'm crazy if I tell you. But then I remembered where I am." She made a small sound that was supposed to be laughter. It did sound jagged. Dentate. "I was going to say I've thought sometimes before, like, the feeling maybe had to do with hope." Hope. Her arms had been crossed over her breasts the whole time, and though the room was overheated, the patient rubbed each palm continually over her upper arms, behavior one associates with chill. The position and movement shielded her inner arms from view. The doctor's eyebrows had gone synclinal from puzzlement without his awareness.
"Bob."
"Bob." The doctor was anxious that his failure to have any idea what the girl was referring to would betray itself and accentuate her feelings of loneliness and psychic pain. Classic unipolars were usually tormented by the conviction that no one else could hear or understand them when they tried to communicate. Hence jokes, sarcasm, the psychopathology of unconscious arm-rubbing. Kate Gompert's head was rolling like a blind person's.
"Jesus, what am I doing here?
Bob Hope. Dope. Sense, stick, grass, smoke." She made a quick Dubois gesture with thumb and finger held to rounded lips. "The dealers down where I buy it, some of them make you call it Bob Hope when you call, in case anybody's accessed the line. You're supposed to ask, is Bob in town? And if they have some, they say, Hope Springs Eternal. Usually. It's like a code. One kid makes you ask him to please commit a crime. The dealers that stay around any length of time tend to be on the paranoid side, as if it would fool anybody who knew enough to bother to access the band on the call." She seemed decidedly more animated. "And one particular guy with snakes in a tank in a trailer in Austin